Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some great conversations lined up for you. For this show, we'll talk about two issues dominating the national conversation during the past few weeks. First, the latest on the coronavirus. As schools reopen across the country and cooler weather, along with flu season, adds new variables to contend with, how does the COVID-19 outbreak currently look here in the U.S.? Then, the confirmation process for Judge Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination will be front and center throughout the month of October. I'll talk to Steve Vladek, professor of law at the University of Texas Law School, about how the Supreme Court works, from Supreme Court sessions to the confirmation of justices. First up, I'm joined by Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network, to give us an update on where things currently stand with the coronavirus outbreak across the country. You can find out more at pandemicactionnetwork.org. Carolyn, we appreciate you joining us for a few minutes. And first of all, what is the state of COVID-19 in the U.S. right now? How are we doing?
Well, Ryan, thanks for having me. I wish I had better news. But the fact is, we've actually hit two grim milestones in the past 2 weeks. More than 200,000 U.S. deaths, 207,000 as of today, according to the Johns Hopkins University site, which does a great job tracing this, and more than 1 million deaths worldwide. These are our families, our neighbors, our colleagues, and we're seeing cases rise and resurgences in some of the states and cities, as well as other countries around the world, which had successfully done a good job before in containing the pandemic. And then in some states and communities that we're seeing very low cases, we're seeing them rise now. And that's because people are moving about and not necessarily doing what they need to do to keep themselves and everyone safe. So COVID is very much still with us here in the United States.
Let's talk about the death toll for a moment, because I want to clear something up for everyone. The CDC recently released some information that showed over 90% of those who died due to COVID-19 had comorbidities. That got misinterpreted by a lot of people. Can you explain the relationship between this coronavirus and underlying conditions like diabetes or heart issues? Because without the COVID-19 infection, most of those who died would likely still be alive today.
Sure, Ryan, let me give it a shot. I mean, I know this has all been an education for all of us, right, on science and public health during this pandemic. When we talk about comorbidities, we talk about other things, health problems that people may have, be that diabetes, be that heart disease, compromised immune systems that may actually make them more susceptible to, if they are infected by COVID, more susceptible to having severe cases or from dying. We also know that certain communities, Black and Brown and Indigenous communities that are being more affected. I think what you're referring to is there was some confusing information that came out about the number of deaths attributed to COVID. And what the CDC was trying to explain was the number, as they always do in reporting deaths, attributing the various factors for why somebody dies. People are dying of COVID. They are also dying of COVID because they had other comorbidities, as you say, again, be that diabetes, heart disease, whatever other issues. So those are contributing factors, but the underlying message is they're dying from this virus.
One issue that we're seeing here in the U.S. that seems to be leading to different people having a different feeling on how we're handling the pandemic is the fact that different regions are getting hit at different times. First, it was the Northwest and Northeast. Then it was the Sun Belt. Now it appears to be the Midwest, the Heartland. How does that complicate things?
That's right. We're a big country and, diseases don't respect borders. So we're a big country. We manage our public health in the places that we live, but in fact, we have to manage public health as a national and global problem, because in an instant, people in one part of the country can bring the disease by taking a car trip, taking an airplane trip, seeing their friends and neighbors. So it can move very quickly. So that is what we've seen throughout this pandemic. We've seen it move from state to state, city to city, and where it cases may fall in one place, but they rise in a number, and that's really attributable to people moving around, which is why it comes back to if everyone can follow the guidance of the CDC and of their local public health departments to do what we know will help to contain the spread of the virus and keep everyone safe, which is wear a mask, wash your hands, and watch your distance.
I'm joined here on iHeartRadio by Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. The website where you can find out more is pandemicactionnetwork.org. There's a couple of new variables that we're dealing with now as opposed to a few months ago, and one of those is the reopening of schools. What do we know about how that could impact our efforts to slow the spread of the virus?
Right. Well, schools obviously bring both children together, but also children with adults, their teachers, other adults who are working in the school, the staff. We know that people being indoors for any period of time with people outside of your household, that is a risk factor for spreading the virus. There are places which are, schools are, I think of course we manage our education system locally, but every school system, every district is having to look at the community spread and what the risk factors are and then make determinations on how and when safely to open schools. And that's going to vary across the country depending on the local spread. I'm here in Washington, D.C. We've been doing a pretty good job containing the virus. So we're online school now, but we're hoping that in the coming months we'll be able to move to hybrid, bringing kids into the classroom. But it's all going to depend on how much the virus is circulating and how schools can keep both the kids and the adults safe.
The other variable that we're dealing with in some parts of the country now and we'll be experiencing in other parts soon is the change in weather. At the very beginning of this pandemic, there was a hope that perhaps warm weather would have a negative impact on the virus. That obviously wasn't the case. But there is an expectation that cooler weather will help spread it. Why is that?
Well, we're very worried about that because we've just kicked off flu season. And if I had any number one advice for all of your listeners is everyone should get a flu shot that can, because we're very worried about what effectively could be a twindemic of flu and COVID-19. And then on top of that, as the weather gets colder, people spend more time indoors. And so, but yet we're all tired of being indoors, right? And we're tired of just seeing our people from our families. So, and we're getting closer to the holidays, to Thanksgiving and the winter holidays, a time when people want to connect and see their families and friends. So those are the risk factors that we're worried about, the combination of the flu and more people spending more time indoors. So that's going to be a need for all of us to remain ever more vigilant.
Is it possible that the precautions we're taking to keep the coronavirus in check, social distancing, the wearing of face masks, the washing of hands, could that help lessen the severity of this flu season?
Well, it's hard to predict, but that certainly will help. If we all are consistent everywhere, and as you said earlier, you know, if no one is safe until everyone is safe. So if everyone is consistently doing those things, wearing a mask, washing their hands, watching their distance, limiting the amount of time they spend indoors with people outside their household, but when they need to do that, wearing a mask, then yes. I mean, the head of the CDC, Dr. Redfield, has said that if everyone were to wear a mask, you know, there is the potential to get the pandemic under control. That means it won't be over, but we can severely limit the spread. And so these are the things that we all need to do to help make that happen.
I'm joined here on iHeartRadio by Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. You can find out more at pandemicactionnetwork.org. You know, there's so many figures and statistics that get quoted and sometimes twisted to fit a certain narrative. We know that most people who get infected with this virus will survive. We know that it has a more severe effect on older people, but there's still a lot that we don't know. When it comes to younger people in particular and the long-term effects of the virus, what have we learned and what are we still unsure about?
Well, Brian, as you say, we're learning every day. Scientists are learning every day more about this virus, and we're going to continue to learn. And that's why also advice on what we can do continues to evolve. I know that's confusing, but that is the nature of an infectious disease that we've never seen before. We are learning that while the deaths have been predominantly among elderly people, we do know that, as you said earlier, comorbidities, people with compromised immune systems and other disease risk factors are more susceptible. We know that it spreads by through the air, by aerosol and by droplets, and that's again why wearing a mask is so important. We know that if we do these things where we maintain distance, where we wear masks, where we wash hands, it's that combination of things that are going to help get it under control, but we're learning new things every day.
Let's talk about the work underway to come up with a safe and effective vaccine. Where does that process stand at the moment?
Yeah, well, look, the good news is the scientific community is working really diligently to expedite a safe and effective vaccine. This has been tremendous progress and unprecedented short period of time. There are a number of vaccines that have moved into what we call phase three trials, meaning they're being tested on a large number of people. And the latest comments from Dr. Fauci, the head of the National Institutes of Health Infectious Diseases, our top infectious disease expert, is that they're increasingly optimistic that we will have a vaccine, one or more vaccines later this year or early next year. But I think it's really important that everyone understands that a vaccine is not a panacea. And even when we do have a vaccine, it's not going to be instantly available to everybody in the U.S. and around the world. So there's going to be a period of time to ramp up manufacturing and distribution. It's going to need to go first and foremost to frontline health workers and other essential frontline health workers. So it's going to take some time. And in the meantime, again, we have to continue to practice what we know works in order to slow the spread. Wear a mask, wash your hands, watch your distance.
Final question for you, and this is really important, I think. There's so much misinformation flooding social media and the internet. It can be a bit overwhelming, and people can begin to believe the wrong thing. How do you recommend everyone inform themselves? What are some resources they should be checking to make sure they have the right information so they can make educated, well-informed decisions about their safety and the safety of their family?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the number one place that I would tell people to go is to the CDC website, cdc.gov, or to your local public health department website, because they're going to have the most up-to-date information about what the virus looks like, what the spread is in your community, and also what the local provisions are to keep people safe and what folks need to do. But I would also say a great resource is the Federation of American Scientists. They have an Ask the Scientist website that they've put up where you can pose your questions and they'll get back. They'll have a scientist to answer your question. And so that's at covid19.fas.org. They're one of our partners in the Pandemic Action Network, and that's a really helpful site to go to ask your questions.
Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. You can learn more about the organization at pandemicactionnetwork.org. Carolyn, thanks so much for lending your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ryan.
Finally, I'm joined by Steve Vladek, professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law and executive director of Just Security and senior editor of the Lawfare blog. He's here to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, from how the nation's high court operates to the confirmation process for Supreme Court justices, a process that will be front and center throughout the month of October. Steve, thanks so much for the time. And let's start at the very beginning. The founders set up this novel system of government involving three different branches, one being the judicial branch. What was the vision that they articulated in Article 3 of the Constitution, really the core purpose of the judiciary?
Yeah, I mean, the very fact that it's a separate article actually is the beginning of the story, because in England, you know, from which we were breaking, the judiciary was not independent. The court was called the King's Bench. And so the founders put the courts in their own article entirely because the founders thought that a critical part of preserving our rights was to have an independent judiciary that could, in appropriate circumstances, act as a check upon the potential tyranny of the majority. So, you know, from the start, the idea was that we would have independent judges who were not politically accountable, who, in appropriate cases, could have the power and indeed the obligation to strike down democratic laws, but democratic laws that were nevertheless in violation of the Constitution.
The Supreme Court always seems to be a hot button issue these days. Some people cast their ballots in presidential races specifically because of the possibility a seat on the bench could open up. Has it always been that way?
So it really has ebbed and flowed. I mean, I think, you know, there are periods in American history where the court was a huge issue. I mean, the Dred Scott decision, where the Supreme Court really goes out of its way to put its stamp on the institution of slavery in 1857, became a galvanizing part of first the 1858 Senate race and the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and then the 1860 presidential election. But I think what's different about today is that the court looks so much like the rest of the country, that, you know, the court really is divided and polarized into much of the same two camps as so many of us. And that's why I think folks tend to see high-profile cases before the court in such partisan terms, and, you know, debates over confirmations in such partisan terms, because, you know, it increasingly looks like the court is just another institution divided into two parties based on who's in charge at the time of the appointment.
There have been some discussions as of late over the amount of justices that should be on the court, or whether or not justices should serve for life, maybe implementing term limits. How are those decisions made in the past, and what flexibility does Congress have to potentially make changes to the court?
Yeah, I mean, the size of the court is perhaps the easier one here, because there's just no question that the Supreme Court is to some degree, at least, subject to Congress's control on that. That, you know, Congress has over time varied the size of the court. At the founding, there were actually six justices. We had as many as 10 for a short period of time in the 1860s before settling at the current number of nine in 1869. So, you know, there's nothing unconstitutional about a statute that would say added two, three, four seats to the court. I think the tricky part is, you know, if you start down that road, then do Republicans, the next time they're in charge, add their own seats to the court? And what does that do for the court's legitimacy in the long term? But at least as a matter of pure constitutional law, you know, it's up to Congress. As long as there's at least one justice, how many more than one is a question of legislative grace. On term limits, that's messier, because we've actually never seen Congress, you know, try to do anything other than allow life tenure for justices. The Constitution doesn't say life tenure. It says, you know, the justices are allowed to hold their offices during, quote, good behavior, unquote. But of course, you know, that doesn't answer the question of what it means to hold their office. Could Congress give them different responsibilities? Could Congress keep paying them but tell them to do nothing? These are questions the Supreme Court's never really had to answer, because they're questions Congress hasn't really ever provoked. So, you know, at least on that one, I think we're in a bit more of uncharted territory.
The purpose behind the lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, why did the founders believe that was necessary?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big part of independence that, you know, when you have a judge, say, who's only serving a 5 or 10 year term, you know, he or she might be making decisions for reasons other than because they think they're the right decisions. They might be, you know, looking over their shoulder at what their next job is going to be. You know, they might be trying to sort of curry favor with whoever's in power to, you know, perhaps be reappointed or appointed to a different position. So the founders thought that one of the ways of ensuring independence was job protection, was to make it clear that, you know, you don't have to worry about finding other jobs. You don't have to worry about having your pay diminished if you hand down unpopular decisions, as a way of just saying that, like, the judges and justices would not be beholden to political pressures, especially when making unpopular decisions.
And one other area where Congress has control over the judiciary, including the Supreme Court, is impeachment power. Certainly not something you see exercised very often, but the power's there, right?
Yeah, I mean, like any other federal officers, judges and justices are subject to impeachment. There's only been one impeachment of a justice on the Supreme Court in all of American history, back in 1805, when the Jeffersonians tried to impeach arch-federalist Samuel Chase, and it failed mostly because it was perceived as a political impeachment, not a substantive one. But there are lower court judges who have been impeached, you know, fairly often for, I think what we would all agree to is clear misconduct. So, you know, there are checks on the courts. Impeachment is one of them. You know, Congress has at least some power over the jurisdiction of the federal courts, deciding which cases they get to hear. Congress controls most of the budget of the federal courts. So it's not that the courts are unaccountable. It's that the accountability comes in different ways and not necessarily at the ballot box. And that's part of how we ensure that courts are able to, you know, protect the rights of minorities, which is perhaps their most important function.
I'm joined by Steve Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law and executive editor of Just Security and senior editor of the Lawfare blog. Before we get into the confirmation process, something the country is about to see play out once again with the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill the seat vacated by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, tell us about how the Supreme Court operates when they're in session.
Yeah, so the court term starts on the first Monday in October, so, you know, coming up. And the court basically, you know, there are sort of two different sets of things that the Supreme Court does. In the big high profile, what we call the merits cases, the court hears these oral arguments and then they hand down these often lengthy opinions. And so last year, for example, the court handed down such opinions in 53 cases. But we're also seeing line more and more that the court also hands down pretty important rulings on what's called the shadow docket, where, you know, it gets a question of like an emergency application of whether a lower court ruling should be allowed to stay in place while the appeal works its way through the court system. The, you know, the court likes to say it's a court of review, not first view, but sometimes it's asked early on, you know, should we leave this lower court ruling in place pending appeal? Should we allow this federal policy to be kept on hold? Should we allow this blocking of an election law to be kept on hold while the case works its way through the courts? Especially in the run-up to the election, I think we're going to see more of those in the news than the typical, you know, more common high-profile merits cases.
And you've actually argued before the Supreme Court. What is that experience like?
It's really intimidating. It's really cool, but I mean, I think one of the things that's hard to appreciate, you know, for folks who have never been in the courtroom is, you know, perhaps more so than any courtroom I've ever seen, when you're arguing in the Supreme Court, you're literally right in front of the justices. I mean, it's about 5 feet from the podium to the Chief Justice. And so, you know, for folks who, especially someone like me as a law professor, I spend so much of my time, you know, teaching about them, teaching what they're doing, to all of a sudden be standing before them and, you know, hoping that you're convincing them, but perhaps also just being yelled at by them. It is an incredibly humbling experience, but also pretty cool.
The nomination and confirmation process. Obviously, there's a lot of debate in this country over all of that due to the developments back in 2016 with the death of Justice Antonin Scalia and how the nomination of Judge Merrick Garland was handled. We then had some very contentious confirmations for Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, and now more debate with the nomination of Judge Barrett so close to the election. But normally, how does the process typically play out?
Well, I think we've seen the what's normal really change in recent years. I mean, so for a long part of American history, even if the nominee was controversial, you know, you often didn't see contentious, very public confirmation hearings. That's really much more of a modern phenomenon. You know, as late as the 1960s, Ryan, we were still confirming justices in the Senate on voice votes, where there wasn't even like a roll call. But I think really over the last, you know, 35 years, the confirmation hearing has become a big part of the process where there's a whole lot of theater involved, political theater, you know, substantive theater, legal theater. And I think part of why that's going on is increased awareness by a larger group of Americans of just how important the court is. And to go back to, you know, something we were talking about earlier, I also think it's because as the court has been perceived in more sharply partisan terms, the confirmation process itself, I think, has been viewed as, you know, just another example of this kind of partisan warfare, where it's a question of who's in charge and who isn't. And so, you know, that's why we saw, you know, back in the 1980s, the very contentious confirmation hearing and rejection of Judge Robert Bork as a nominee, Clarence Thomas, very controversial confirmation hearing. And even for the non-controversial nominees, we've still had hearings. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Antonin Scalia, they were both confirmed unanimously, but they both still went through this, you know, arduous process of going through the Senate. So I think it's very much in line with the growing, you know, perception of the court as political and indeed the growing politicization of the court that now this is, you know, regardless of who the nominee is and regardless of which seat they're filling, this is a big deal.
Does it also have to do with the fact the system has just gotten a little out of whack over the past couple of decades? Congress ceding a lot of power and control to the other two branches, which in effect increases the impact and importance of those branches.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually true both at the front end and the back end. And what I mean by that is, you know, in the old days, it wasn't necessarily the case that the president would be able to confirm anyone when his party was in charge of the Senate. I mean, there actually used to be meaningful pushback by the Senate against nominees of their own party in certain cases. And I think that's one of the things that's changed in recent years. We've really seen the Senate, you know, cede any substantive disapproval authority as long as, you know, the majority in the Senate is the same party as the president. And then, yes, once we have the justices on the court, you know, I really do think that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you know, there's so much more of an incentive these days if you're a politician to deflect hard questions to the courts because it's easier to sort of blame the courts than it is to take a stand. That, you know, we saw this with DACA. I mean, the Trump administration, part of why it got into trouble when it tried to rescind DACA is because instead of just saying we don't like DACA, they tried to argue that they had to rescind DACA because DACA was unlawful. And that's part of why the Supreme Court rejected the rescission of DACA. So I think there's a lot of effort to deflect accountability to the courts, which, yes, I think absolutely has the, if not intended, at least inevitable consequence that more and more of the high-profile divisive disputes in our country end up becoming judicial questions.
I'm joined right now by Steve Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. Final item I want to touch on, because I'm sure it's one the casual observer may not fully understand, judicial philosophy. People hear that a segment of the court is conservative, another segment is liberal. They hear terms like originalism and textualism and judicial activism. If you don't mind, as best you can, step us through what some of that means.
I could try, although I think one of the problems is that we tend to have these conversations at such a level of superficiality that it's hard to get into the weeds. Let's just take an example. So the Constitution bars cruel and unusual punishments in the Eighth Amendment. And, you know, one of the questions is, what makes a punishment unusual? Right, the Constitution doesn't define the word unusual. We probably all have our own colloquial definitions of unusual. Should we interpret the Eighth Amendment by reference to whether a punishment was unusual at the time that provision was adopted in 1791? Or should we interpret the Eighth Amendment to mean it's unusual in context, it's unusual today? And that's something the Supreme Court has actually fought about a lot. And so one who is an ardent originalist would say all that matters is what the public meaning of the words were at the time they were adopted. And by that logic, there would be plenty of things that, you know, we might think of today as unconscionable punishments that would not be unusual for Eighth Amendment purposes because they weren't unusual in 1791. The, you know, folks who are less, I think, wedded to originalism would say, no, the words have to be interpreted in context. And so when we ask if, you know, John Doe's punishment is unusual, what we're asking is it unusual compared to everybody else at the time he's punished? You know, that debate times, I don't know, 2000 is the methodological debate over the Constitution because, you know, there are some provisions in the Constitution that are just unambiguous. The president has to be 35. We don't really fight over what 35 means. But the Constitution has a lot of words that are not necessarily obvious. And even more, right, the Constitution doesn't address a lot of scenarios. And so the question is, in the context where either the text is ambiguous or where the text is just not specific at all, doesn't address the problem, right, what should control? Should what the founders thought in 1789, 1791 control? Or should what is true today be the relevant baseline? That is, you know, really the heart of the debate between progressives and conservatives when it comes to methodology today.
Steve Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law and executive editor of Just Security and senior editor of the Lawfare blog. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to explain all of that for us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
As we wrap things up, I want to offer a big thanks to all of our guests and, of course, to all of you for listening to iHeartRadio Communities. If you want to hear previous episodes of this show, we're on your iHeartRadio app. Just search for iHeartRadio Communities. And you can find me on social media at Ryan E. Gorman. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Stay safe.